Hey there, it's Stephen Dubner. This summer, we are revisiting favorite episodes from the Freakonomics Radio archive. This one is called Spite Happens. Feel free to check out our entire archive at freakonomics.com. And as always, thank you so much for listening.
It probably was pretty darn painful because you're not living in a world with good razors. The chances are what they're using is kitchen cutlery, I would imagine. And that is not necessarily all that sharp. And I can't imagine how painful it was.
That's Lisi Oliver. She studies medieval law at Louisiana State University. What do you think she's talking about that was so darn painful?
Between the 5th and the 12th century in early modern Europe, barbarity swept through the continent and also the island of England, and often the targets of these attacks were monasteries and nunneries. But nunneries, you had the added incentive of rape to add to sort of pillage and destruction.
For a nun, rape was especially problematic, aside from the obvious reasons. Rape violated a nun's chastity, which meant that as a bride of Christ, she might be forbidden entry into heaven. So what do you do if you are a nun and there are barbarians at the gate? In the 9th century, one nun, an abbess who came to be known as Saint Ebba, came up with a plan. Here's Lisi Oliver reading from a history by Roger of Wendover.
The abbess, with an heroic spirit, took a razor and with it cut off her nose, together with her upper lip onto the teeth, presenting herself a horrible spectacle to those who stood by. Filled with admiration at this admirable deed, the whole assembly followed her maternal example and severally did the like to themselves. When this was done, together with the morrow's dawn, the pagan attackers came. On beholding the abbess and the sisters so outrageously mutilated and stained with their own blood from the sole of their foot unto their head, they retired in haste from the place. Their leaders ordered their wicked followers to set fire and burn the monastery with all its buildings and its holy inmates. Which being done by these workers of iniquity, the holy abbess and all the most holy virgins with her attained the glory of martyrdom. There's a very graphic picture of St. Ebba cutting her nose and lip off and all of the women around her looking thrilled at the concept. In terms of pain, it must have just been dreadful to cut your nose off at night and then wait until the morning with that pain racking your body. But that is the pain of martyrdom. It's the crown of thorns.
I know it's hard to transpose oneself to a different time and place, but if you could put yourself back in a nunnery, do you think you would have followed suit and gone ahead and cut off your own nose to spite your face?
Probably.
Why?
I think that there is a wave of hysteria that follows that kind of action where I don't think I would have been number two, but I probably would have been number 20. I mean, it's the happening thing, man. We're all cutting our noses off, right?
Now, why are we telling you this grisly tale? Because today we're going to talk about spite, as in cutting off your nose to spite your face. Scholars aren't certain, but this phrase quite likely originates with the practice of medieval nuns like St. Ebba, women who mutilated themselves in an attempt to preserve their chastity. Now, economics is all about trade-offs. Everything has a cost and a benefit. What do you make of the nuns' trade-off? Was it worth it?
This is Freakonomics Radio, the show that explores the hidden side of everything. Here's your host, Stephen Dubner.
First up on the show today, we're talking about spite. We're going to look at why people sometimes try to hurt others, even when it's very costly to themselves. Now, it struck me that spite is, in some ways, an economic concept. So I called up an economist I know, Steve Levitt. He's my Freakonomics friend and co-author, teaches at the University of Chicago.
So when I think about spite as an economist, the way I would think of spite is that it is the response of an individual who has been wronged in some way by another, who then is willing in the future to pay a large cost in order to punish the person who wronged him in the first place. So in a strange sense, it's not a very economic concept because in general, we don't think that people are going to be overly willing to pay a lot of costs themselves to punish other people.
Yeah, I think what you described is more revenge than spite, though.
All right, so I don't even know what spite is. What is spite?
Excellent question. Well, it's not so easy indeed to define spite.
That's Benedikt Herrmann. He's also an economist, originally from Germany. Now he works as a policy officer for the European Commission. He's done a lot of research on antisocial behavior. You might, in fact, call him a scholar of spite.
Let's have an easy start here and define spite as a behavior where an individual is ready to harm him or herself at own cost, to harm somebody else without creating anything good for a third party, for anyone outside. Because you could sometimes be nasty to somebody just because he or she has misbehaved and you would like to do it in a kind of educational way, which then I would not call spite.
Because it's not costing you anything.
No, if I'm punishing somebody who has misbehaved to the community, to our group, if I punish him or her at own cost, it could look like spite, but it's not spite because it's an educational momentum. You try to get somebody who has done something bad to behave better in the future. So it's a kind of moralistic way of punishing, a moralistic way of being aggressive. And so it's not the kind of spite I'm after. I'm after the kind of behavior where somebody would harm others with for no reason, for no moral reason, apart from something that might satisfy him or herself only.
Traditional economics argues that most people try to satisfy their self-interest, to maximize their profits and opportunities. Economists have a name for this model of self-interest, Homo economicus. But within that framework, spite is a bit puzzling. Why would someone pay outsized costs for no benefit other than to hurt someone else? Well, Benedikt Herrmann thinks that the idea of homo economicus is a bit archaic. He prefers a different term.
Homo rivalis, yes, indeed.
Homo rivalis. Meaning that humans are driven at our core by competition rather than simple self-interest. Homo economicus wants to get as much as possible for himself. Homo rivalis just wants to make sure he gets more than the other guy. In other words, as much as we like to think that we are absolute animals, we are, in fact, relative animals. Now, we know this in part through the experimental games that economists like to play. One of the classics is called the ultimatum game. Here's Steve Levitt again.
So the ultimatum game is a little experimental game that the behavioral economists have developed, in which two players come into the lab and they're completely anonymous. They'll never meet each other. It's a one-shot game. And one player is given, say, $10, and they're allowed to divide that $10 however they'd like between themselves and the other player. That other player is then informed about the way in which the division has occurred and is given a choice. They can either accept the division, say $7 for the person who's splitting the pot and $3 for me, or I have another option to say, no, I prefer both of us to get zero. Okay, so what you always face a choice between as the recipient of the ultimatum is I can accept what the other person offered me, or I can have us both get zero. And empirically, what we see is that rarely will anyone accept an offer that's less than 20%. So if the person who splits the pot divides it more unevenly than 75-25, you're almost guaranteed to have it rejected, even though the rejector is giving up the 25 or the 20% of their own money in order to take the 75 or the 80% away from you.
Now, to an economist, this might seem perplexing. Why am I willing to throw away two or three of my dollars just to make sure that you don't get seven or eight? Well, maybe it's because I feel you've wronged me by splitting the pot so unevenly. But remember what Benedict Herman said earlier about spite. True spite, as he sees it, is not motivated by a desire to punish someone's bad behavior. So he wanted to see how people behave absent such a moral incentive. He and a colleague came up with an experiment.
So let me quickly try to explain here on the radio how this experiment worked. So you would be invited to our experiment like many other students. You don't know each other. You come to our lab inside. You have to sit behind computers. You are requested not to talk with anyone during the whole experiment.
So you're paired with another player, but you don't see that person. You each get $10, and then you're given an option. If you surrender $1 of your money, you can destroy $5 of the other person's wealth. Now, there's no revenge going on here. There wouldn't seem to be anything for you to gain by destroying the other person's money. But as Benedict Herman found, about 10% of the players did take that option. Herman calls such a player a difference maximizer.
That means that we want to maximize the payoff differential between the opponent and us. So maybe in a more picturesque way, being aware that we are losing our trousers for the sake and for the hope that the opponent will lose both the shirt and the trousers.
In other words, some people were always willing to cut off their noses to spite the other player. Herman was perplexed by this finding. And he tried the experiment in a variety of versions, variety of settings, different parts of the world, different kinds of societies. But in each case, he found that a surprising number of people would give up some of what was theirs for the sole purpose of taking something away from someone else. And what are you as the researcher thinking? Are you thinking this is remarkably surprising, sad, strange, irrational? What is your – I mean, on the one hand, you must be excited because for the sake of a paper, it's a fascinating finding.
This exactly – these are the two souls of a researcher. Of course, on the one side, exactly as you said it very nicely, you are very excited. But on the other side, of course, you start thinking, oh, my God, who the heck are we? Mm. We, the humans. For me, the outcome of all this research is definitely a kind of sadness and also worry that we can be too fast, we humans, we can get too fast into intergroup conflict, which don't make any sense to anyone. That we start to harm each other, that we start innocent people to kill each other for something that at the end of the day could have been decided in a much more reasonable way.
Now, as interesting as this may be, as believable as it may be, Steve Levitt warns us not to make too much of lab experiments like these. It's hard to extrapolate from a lab setting to the hurly-burly of the real world.
When people are in the lab, they're completely anonymous. It's the only time we'll ever play. But the real world isn't usually like that.
Indeed. So, after the break, we'll get back to the real world, see if we can find a story where someone willingly gives up money, and not just a few bucks like in these lab games, but lots and lots of bucks in order to prove a point.
Well, the contract he was offered was 5 years, $7.66 million.
Spite may cost you a lot, but our podcast, completely free. You can subscribe at Apple Podcasts, Stitcher, or come visit us at Freakonomics.com. Thanks. Freakonomics Radio is supported by the Cy Sims Foundation, since 1985 supporting progress in education, science, and the arts. Information at cysimsfoundation.org.
Freakonomics Radio is supported by Progressive Insurance, offering Snapshot, a device designed to reward safe drivers. Learn more at progressive.com or 1-800-PROGRESSIVE. Now that's progressive.
This is Freakonomics Radio. Here's your host, Stephen Dubner.
We are talking today about spite, about actions that hurt someone else, but are especially costly to ourselves. Dave O'Connor is a filmmaker with Majordomo Media in New York. He was the executive producer of a documentary film made for ESPN called You Don't Know Bo. The Bo in question is Bo Jackson.
Hey. He's remarkable, and look at that one. Bo Jackson says hello.
He's just so quick. Look at that burst.
Bo Jackson back, leaps, and he makes the catch.
Nobody catches Bo.
The answer is no. Bo has another.
Bo on the charge. Bo is there.
Bo knows exactly what he's doing.
Spider-Man.
Bo was probably the single greatest athlete of his generation. Two sports star, football and baseball, and was just a transformative athlete. And he just physically, there's something about his presence that feels different than normal human beings.
Is it a bird? Is it a plane? It's Super Bowl!
In the spring of 1986, Bo Jackson was playing his senior year of college baseball at Auburn.
He showed signs of being a very highly valued Major League Baseball player.
I'm tearing the cover off the ball. I'm batting over 400. Oh, I don't know how many home runs I was sitting on then.
That's Jackson himself from the film. Now, he had just completed his senior season of college football, which had gone even better. Dave O'Connor again.
Football, his senior year, is one of the all-time great seasons of a running back in college football. He rushes for nearly 1,800 yards. He wins the Heisman Trophy and basically enshrines himself as a legend of college football. Sort of the common wisdom was that Bo will be the number one draft pick in football. He will probably not play baseball at all. And if he does, somebody should pick him in the 20th round or 30th round on a flyer just in case.
Right, you don't want to waste a pick on a guy who's going to be playing football.
Right.
So while finishing up his college baseball career, Jackson starts getting courted by NFL teams. The football draft happens before the baseball draft. The number one overall NFL pick is held by the Tampa Bay Buccaneers, who are owned by a man named Hugh Culverhouse. The Bucs have made it clear that they want Bo Jackson.
I was all gung-ho, and I had taken a few trips to visit some teams my senior year. I got the okay to go visit Tampa Bay. Hugh Culverhouse sent his jet to Columbus Airport, drove over, got on the jet, went to Tampa Bay for my visit. It was almost like a college visit when you're a high school senior and you're going to visit a college and they get some of the players to show you around town, to show you the night spots, take you to a nice restaurant, and entertain you. About 4 or 5 days later, I'm back at Auburn getting ready for my baseball game. And I walked out on the field, and as I get to the gate to come around the dugout, Coach Baird approaches me. And so he said, Bo, can I talk to you for a second? I said, sure, Coach. He said, let's go over behind the dugout. Let's go sit and talk. I said, all right. So we go behind the dugout. And I'm thinking that he's going to tell me, hey, some big league team wants to sign me. And he said, did you take a trip last week on Hugh Culverhouse's jet to go down to visit Tampa? I said, yes. And the folks checked and said that it was okay. They checked with the NCAA and said that it was okay to do that. He said, well, Bo, somebody didn't check, and the NCAA has declared you ineligible for any more college sports, so you can't play baseball no more. And I sit there on that ground, and I cried like a baby. I cried like a baby.
Bo Jackson immediately felt that he'd been wronged. He loved baseball, and even though it looked like he was going to play football professionally, he was distraught about being barred from finishing out his college baseball career. And what's more, he became convinced that Hugh Culverhouse, the Tampa Bay owner, had done this to Bo on purpose.
Because the officials at Tampa Bay told me personally, yes, we checked and they said that it was okay. I think it was all a plot now just to get me ineligible from baseball because they saw the season that I was having and they thought that they were going to lose me to baseball. And if we declare him ineligible, then we got him.
Now, we don't know whether the Bucks actually meant for this to happen, but it certainly did seem to work out well for them. They were in line to pick Bo Jackson number one in the NFL draft and pay him so much money that he'd forget about baseball in a heartbeat. It was just one problem. Bo Jackson isn't the forgetting type.
And I said, there is no way I'm signing with Tampa Bay. And I told Hugh Culverhouse, I said, you draft me if you want. You're going to waste a draft pick. I said, I promise you that. And Hugh Culverhouse, well, this is what I'm going to offer you as a signing bonus, and you're going to take it whether you want it or not. I said, all right. They didn't think I was serious.
In the NFL draft that April, Tampa Bay did select Bo Jackson with the number one pick, which was attached to a $7.66 million five-year contract. And then, a couple of months later, Bo Jackson was selected in the baseball draft, in the fourth round, by the Kansas City Royals. They offered him 3 years at just $1 million. The choice would seem obvious, but Bo doesn't know obvious. He rejects a football offer, and he takes the baseball offer. How surprising is this? Here's Dave O'Connor again.
Unprecedented. It just doesn't happen. You can't... I mean, money talks, right? I mean, you have $7.6 million sitting there, and you sign a contract for one. That's a rare occurrence.
It sounds like a decision that very few people that I know, at least, would have made. Do you think that was an act of spite on Bo Jackson's part?
It's interesting because I think Bo would say that he did the honorable thing and that he has a code. But when you look at it on its surface, it is spite. There is no rational explanation for walking away from that kind of money. He's not just hurting himself here. He's also doing this to hurt Tampa Bay. The opportunity cost of losing a first-round draft pick isn't just that Bo Jackson isn't playing on my team. It's that every other player I could have selected with that pick is not playing on my team either. So it's a huge impact to Tampa Bay, not to mention the public relations nightmare of going out on a limb and selecting somebody and not getting him.
So Jackson does sign with the Royals. He starts the year in the minor leagues, but by the end of the season, he makes a major league team. He's on track for a nice baseball career, and then the next year, he becomes eligible to re-enter football. Now, will he play? Nobody knows. But the Los Angeles Raiders draft him in the seventh round. He signs, and suddenly, he's playing two professional sports. At the end of the baseball season, he jumps straight into football, and he became a star in both. He also becomes a household name, in part because of his athletic feats, and in part because he was the star of one of the most beguiling ad campaigns in history, Bo Knows for Nike.
Bo knows baseball.
Bo knows football. Bo knows basketball, too.
Bo could surf. Bo could rollerblade. Bo could not play ice hockey. That was the one thing that they couldn't agree to let him actually be able to do. Gretzky shakes his head and says,
no.
But pretty much everything else, volleyball, tennis, running, lifting weights, aerobics, all kinds of stuff.
Bo, you don't know diddly.
All right, so we agree that Bo Jackson's athletic career turned out pretty well, remarkable on some dimensions, but overall not one of the greatest ever because it wasn't long enough, perhaps. We agree that because he was such an unusual athlete in two sports, he became this icon and the focus of a remarkable and probably quite remunerative ad campaign, right? We agree on this so far?
Yes.
Do we therefore agree that had this catastrophe not happened with him, with getting drafted for the NFL by a team that out of spite or something like spite he turned down, that if that had not happened, that all the rest may not have happened.
Yeah, I think that's a plausible argument to make, because he probably, had he signed that deal with Tampa Bay, if he doesn't get injured, he probably becomes one of the best running backs in NFL history. But that's probably it.
I mean, honestly, my takeaway lesson here is spite pays.
Yeah, you would say, I mean, if you take a look at where he ends up, spite certainly paid in his case.
So here's a question worth thinking about. If spite indeed exists, is it something that we humans have always carried around in our genetic code, or do we pick it up along the way?
We're a very biological organism, and we've inherited an awful lot. In fact, most of the basic emotions that guide us from our animal and Paleolithic early human past.
That is E.O. Wilson. He's a renowned biologist and author.
And that's Catherine Wells. She was a producer on our show when we first aired this episode. Catherine, you had a chat with Professor Wilson, yes?
I did. It was cool. So I called him up because I wanted to know where all of this self-destructive spite comes from. You know, is this a common behavior throughout nature, or are we unusual in it? And I have to say that I just assumed that we would be the meanest creatures in existence, given everything we've heard today. But Wilson said that wasn't true.
Oh, no, we only moderately mean.
Now, E.O. Wilson has done a lot of thinking about the origins of human behavior, and he thinks the nastiness that we see in animals might give us a clue to why we act the way we do.
There are a couple of cases in the ants where the workers have a huge gland of poisonous material containing it, and when they get into a tough fight, they are able to contract their abdomens and explode their abdomens so that sticky poison covers the enemy. It can disable several enemies doing that by giving its life.
The list of this kind of behavior goes on and on.
I mean, things that you really don't want to think about too much before you go to sleep, and you might have nightmares. But here's the story about spite. If we define spite as doing harm to someone else at the cost of harm to yourself, and that involves a surrender of some advantage or emotional reward on your part, that might not exist.
In nature.
And it's very difficult to find any case in the great encyclopedia of animal aggression where it doesn't give some advantage to the individual doing the aggression. But it's very rare that an animal would deliberately injure itself just in order to create injury in another individual without any further gain to itself. To deliberately do that. I think spite does not exist in the animal kingdom. Now,
in the way that it does in humans.
Let's take humans. When a person injures himself or herself, say in reputation, in diminishing wealth, causing their own early death, whatever it is, in order to harm another person, you would say, oh, that's spite. That's got to be spite. But it really would be true spite in my mind, as opposed to mere risk-taking or trade-off for one kind of gain in exchange for one kind of loss taken, if you can't see a gain. And that's hard to imagine. Even vengeance has its gain. It has a strong emotional award. Even a mass murderer who goes out and harms a lot of people is taking some benefit, emotional benefit from that, when suicide is intended. It's a lot of mass murders are just a terrible form of suicide in which a person decides to get the satisfaction in advance of committing it. And maybe the satisfaction the person will get in striking out against something they imagine to have been their enemy and diminished them before. So when you add that factor, maybe real spite does not exist.
So I don't know whether this is a relief or not. I mean, the idea that spite might not even exist seems good, but the fact that we get personal satisfaction out of hurting other people? I told Wilson that was kind of a bummer.
That just shows you're not a psychopath.
I'm a total wuss. But here's the upside. Spite is not the only motivation we have for being self-destructive. There's actually another. Altruism. When we hurt ourselves, we aren't always doing it just to hurt someone else. Sometimes we're doing it to help.
One of the things that makes us human is our internally conflicted nature, confliction, our ambivalence to our own selves. We are constantly wrestling with our conscience and with a tendency to deviate from social norms in a risky way and to do wrong. To be selfish. The contest within us between doing the moral thing, even the heroic thing on one side, and doing the selfish, perhaps even criminal thing on the other side, that contest is what gives us such a continuously conflicted nature. If we went and became completely altruistic, then we would be like ants. If we went to the opposite extreme and had complete lack of constraint, and it was complete individualism, then we would have chaos. We would not have order. The group would dissolve. So we have to be in the middle. This appears to be the human condition.
It's funny listening to him talk about that.
That's Steve Levitt again. He took a class with Wilson when he, Levitt, was an undergrad at Harvard. He's very fond of the way Wilson thinks.
There could be no two disciplines closer than evolutionary biology and economics. And they studied different questions and they used different methods. But the way that evolutionary biologists think is exactly like the way that economists think. Both are very much a model of behavior, of individual behavior, and individual behavior that's motivated by costs and benefits. The other thing is that at its heart, both economics and evolutionary biology strive for simplicity. That the simplest story, which can explain a set of facts, is the one that we gravitate to, as opposed to other disciplines, history. History is all about complexity. And, you know, literature is all about complexity. Even sociology, I think, at heart is about complexity. But economics is about simplicity.
Like E.O. Wilson, Levitt thinks that spite, true spite, may not really exist. Because that would mean that I hurt you even though I get nothing for it. Nothing. And while it may seem that I get nothing, I probably get something.
What I would say about spite, I would say this, to know that an act is spite, you have to be inside the head of the perpetrator, because the idea of spite is that it's being done without benefit. But it's interesting because one of the first premises of economics is you can never really know what other people are thinking and why they're doing what they're doing. Instead, we focus on what they do. And so consequently, my view is forget about what's going on inside of other people's heads. You'll probably never know what it is. And focus on what they're actually doing.
Do you see altruism as sort of the flip side of the coin to spite, and therefore not quite real?
Altruism is exactly the flip side of spite, in the sense that there are acts which very well could be altruistic, but equally could be done in a perfectly self-interested way. Both make you feel really good, and it feels good to help other people sometimes, and it feels so good to punish other people who've wronged you. So I think they're both actually completely consistent with the idea of people doing the best they can.
And what about you personally, Levitt? Do you get more satisfaction generally from helping people or punishing people?
I'm a lover, not a fighter. You know that, don't you? I like to help people.
When we come back, we'll shift from spite to shame. And we'll visit Bogota, Colombia, to learn what the mayor there, a most unusual mayor, did about the traffic jams.
We used mimes as a local replacement in a small part of the city of the traffic police.
Excuse me, Mayor Mokas, you said you replaced the traffic police with mimes?
Yes.
That's coming up on Freakonomics Radio.
Freakonomics Radio is supported by TransferWise, an online service that lets people send and receive currencies internationally. And their borderless account lets customers hold and convert multiple currencies at any time. More at TransferWise.com and the app.
This is Freakonomics Radio. Here's your host, Stephen Dubner.
We just told you all about spite. In the next part of the hour, we're leaving that behind to talk about what social scientists call pro-social behavior. So if you want people to behave better, to treat others well, to contribute to our collective good, how do you accomplish that? We'll start in Bogota, Colombia, on a busy street in the middle of traffic. It's pretty chaotic. Horse carts right beside BMWs, bikes and pedestrians and buses all competing for the same patch of pavement. But as bad as traffic is now, it used to be worse.
Oh my God, it's just crossing the street. It was an act of falling, maybe.
That's Margarita Martinez. She's a journalist and filmmaker.
Because you wouldn't have an assurance that it was red, no one was gonna let you walk, but maybe they felt like they just could, you know, kept driving. You know, the traffic lights didn't mean anything. It was just like a suggestion, not really something that would be enforced. Back then, they didn't even exist rules. So we can say it was the jungle.
In the early 1990s, Bogota was one of the most dangerous cities around. Its homicide rate was triple that of New York's, and traffic fatalities were also very common, with a rate more than four times of New York's. But in 1994, Bogota voted in a new mayor, a most unusual mayor. His name was Antanas Mokas. How unusual was he? Well, Mokas had previously served as president of Bogota's National University, but he resigned after an incident in which he mooned a group of unruly students. Still, in a city as chaotic as Bogota, maybe he was just the kind of mayor they needed.
I felt free to be a little bit outside of the normal behavior.
That's Mokas. He wound up serving two terms as mayor, from 1995 to 1997, and again from 2001 to 2003. He did all kinds of things that weren't quite normal behavior. He gave tens of thousands of citizens a placebo vaccine against violence. He preached the evils of graffiti by dressing up as a character he called Super Citizen in a spandex suit. He encouraged people to take out their aggression on balloons rather than one another. And he also had an idea for that terrible traffic.
The traffic police was very corrupted. And we used mimes as a local replacement in a small part of the city of the traffic police.
Excuse me, Mayor Mokas, you said you replaced the traffic police with mimes?
Yes.
It is maybe worth pointing out here how Mokus spells his name. It's M-O-C-K-U-S, as in mock us. Here's Margarita Martinez again. She has directed a film about Mokus.
So, for example, you were crossing the street, not through the crosswalk, but through, you know, the middle of the street. And then the mime followed you with this really funny and kind of playful waves. And they mimic the way you walked and how you did your hair or whatever. And you felt that you were the worst citizen in the world. And after that, that was a lesson that you learned in your heart, you know, not in your pocket, that you were shamed, shamed, profoundly shamed because of these mimes and everybody in front of you.
It wasn't just the mimes. Mokus's government handed out thousands of cards to drivers. On one side, the card had a cartoon drawing of a thumbs up, and on the other side, a thumbs down, a red thumbs down, kind of like the red card that a soccer referee uses to eject a player from a game.
It was just a very polite way to change people's behavior and to take out the anger that you had when someone did something terrible, but also the other person felt like, oh, I'm being seen. People don't agree with what I'm doing, and it was also shameful.
Yes, well, shaming is a way of educating.
It was a very polite way of insulting you. It seems ridiculous, probably, but they really work.
So the mayor of Bogota, Antanas Mokus, had some serious problems to solve, and he thought that shame might help him. From the beginning of his first term until the end of his second term, life got much better in Bogota. The homicide rate fell dramatically. Now, this probably had a lot more to do with new gun laws and alcohol laws than with mimes, but observers generally agree that Mokus's shaming technique sent a valuable message. The rules of this city have changed, and if you need help upholding these new rules, well, we're going to make your fellow citizens help you. Traffic fatalities also fell over the 8 years that bracketed Mokus's reign by roughly 60%. Now, even though most of us don't have mimes to help shape our behavior, we do all follow cues that suggest what is acceptable behavior and what's not. In academic circles, they are known as social norms. They're the way we try to avoid being the nail that's sticking out.
If we're uncertain about what we should do in a situation, one shortcut way of knowing what's probably the right thing for us to do here is to look at what our peers are doing.
That's Robert Cialdini. He's an emeritus professor of psychology and marketing at Arizona State University.
Birds flock together in very neat patterns. Fish school, cattle herd, social insects swarm together. So this is something that doesn't require a lot of cognitive capacity in order to trigger the conformity. All you need to do is to see what those around you like you are doing, and it's a good shortcut to deciding what you should do in a situation.
Years back, Cialdini wrote a book that became a classic in business circles. It's called Influence. His research career has been dedicated to the power of social norms. For instance, in one experiment, Cialdini wanted to know what would influence people to reduce their home energy consumption. So he and his researchers went around neighborhoods in San Diego hanging signs on people's doors. They used four different versions of the sign so they could measure the effectiveness of each one.
The message said, please reduce energy in your home in order to reduce the expenditure of resources on the planet. Another said, please reduce energy consumption in the home in order to save money at the end of the month on your own bill. A third said, please do this for future generations so that your children will have access to these resources. And then we had yet another that we've never seen employed. And it said simply, the majority of your neighbors are regularly undertaking efforts to reduce energy in their homes. Please follow.
That's it. It doesn't say the majority of your neighbors are doing better than you or worse than you. It just says they're doing stuff.
Right.
And we're going to put this ball in your court now, and you should do stuff too.
Right.
Okay.
And then we measured their energy use at the end of the month. We were actually going into their yards, risking vicious dogs and sprinkling systems, and we looked at their energy use as a result of receiving one or another of those messages. Two interesting findings.
Wait, before you even give it, because if people are listening to this, whether you're a policymaker, a parent, or a teacher, like, you're about to tell them kind of the secret of the universe, aren't you? Like, everybody wants to encourage what you call pro-social behavior, get people to do things that are collectively better for all of us. But you're telling me that through this one experiment, at least, that you kind of know how all of us can be doing this thing, right?
Well, you're right to use the caveat through this one experiment, least. There is one secret to the universe that we seem to under-recognize, and it is... what those around us are doing powerfully influences what we choose to do next. Even though we tend to think of ourselves as freestanding entities, immune to the blandishments of information and evidence from those around us, no. We are powerfully influenced. And in this case, it was the only message that significantly reduced energy consumption in the home.
So the only one that had any effect was the one that said people around you are doing this already. It didn't even say that they're doing better than you or worse
than you,
right?
Exactly right.
So what the heck does that mean other than, I mean, my layperson's knee-jerk reaction is, Dr. Cialdini, you're telling me that, oh, we basically are herd animals as much as we like to think that we're not.
We are at a very elemental level. Of course we are, because this is an adaptive approach to our environment.
Right. So when I hear you say that, I say, well, yes, that makes good sense on a scientific level and on a kind of emotional level as well. But I, and I'm guessing most people listening to this would say this as well, I'm not like that. I don't travel with the herd like that. I think for myself. So what I really want to ask you now is, well, what kinds of people – first of all, most of us are probably wrong. We think we all think we're above average, certainly. And I'm probably wrong. I'm probably much more herd-like than I think. But I guess the next thing I want to know out of that is, what kind of people are least susceptible to that kind of herd thinking? I'm guessing from your San Diego energy experiment, we don't know that because you don't know too much about the demographics of each of these individuals. Am I right?
That's right. But let me say that from that study, we also interviewed people in those neighborhoods and asked them of these four messages, do this for the environment, do this to save money, do this for future generations, or do this because your neighbors are doing it. We asked them, which of these would be most powerful in spurring you into energy conservation? The one that was by far the least rated as a motivator of their change was the one that was indeed the one that did lever their change the greatest, the one that said that your neighbors are doing this. And this leads to a real problem, which is because people don't believe that these kinds of pulls and draws and motives affect them powerfully, when they get into positions of developing programs to create pro-social behavior, they don't think of this one.
Yeah.
Because when they introspect, they say, oh, this wouldn't work on me. Why would I load it into the wording of a message designed to move people in pro-social directions?
But it doesn't always work, does it? Pure information does not always work. Give me an example of where telling people what other people are doing actually might have a boomerang effect.
We've recognized that very often public service messages are designed to move people in societally desirable directions by telling them how many people are behaving in undesirable directions. So many people are drinking and driving. Mm-hmm. We have to stop this. Yeah. Teenage pregnancy is so prevalent in our schools. We have to do something about this. Tax fraud is so rampant that we have to increase the penalties for
it. And that's a natural instinct, right? To whip out the evidence to beat people on the head with it, right?
Right. It's a very human but wrong-headed strategy because the subtext message is a lot of people just like you are doing this.
And therefore, I too.
Yeah. So it normalizes, it legitimizes the undesirable behavior. We've actually done a study in this regard. I live in Arizona, and there's something here called the Petrified Forest National Park. Their problem is people steal pieces of petrified wood from the forest floor and crystals very frequently. And the problem is widespread enough that it is undermining the integrity of the forest. And so there is a sign as you enter the park that says, because so many people are stealing wood from the forest floor at the rate of nearly a ton a month, it is undermining the integrity of the forest. I had a graduate student who was working with me, and he and his fiance went to the forest, and they saw that sign. And he said, before he was finished reading it, he heard his fiance, who he counts as the single most honest person he's ever met in his life, say to him, "We better get ours now." Right? What could possibly do that? Take this otherwise wholly honest young woman and turn her into an environmental criminal who is depleting a national treasure in the process.
And but also you're thinking, well, if they're taking a ton a month, I'm only going to take a few ounces. That's nothing compared to a ton.
Yeah, and we put that sign in front of certain pathways that ran through the forest, and we salted those pathways with pieces of petrified wood. And then we looked to see what the effect of that sign was on stealing the wood that we had marked compared to a control condition that didn't get any sign, right? It nearly tripled theft.
So if you're trying to influence someone else's behavior, it's good to keep in mind the power of social norms. But those norms are tricky. It's hard to tell what kind of shaming and peer pressure will work and what might backfire. I called up my Freakonomics co-author, Steve Levitt.
From an economic perspective, shame is a wonderful punishment because unlike imprisonment, it's free. It's not only free, that society can impose as much shame as they want on people without any kind of cost or resources used up. But in fact, the rest of society actually likes it when other people get shamed. People love to read in the National Enquirer, the New York Times about the shame that comes down on public people. So it's actually a really incredibly efficient mechanism for punishing people who do things we don't like. The only thing that's hard about it, the only real shortcoming associated with shame is that someone's got to be willing to be shamed. So, for instance, after we published Freakonomics, some of my colleagues were not that wild about the book and the attention we received. And so to try to shame me, one of my colleagues put up anonymously on the bulletin board for the Department of Economics a supposed quote from me that said, they claimed that I had said that mathematics was not required to understand reality. Okay? And this was supposed to be the most shameful, embarrassing quote. And the idea was, if it was known publicly that I had said this, that it would ruin my reputation and I would feel awful about myself. But in fact, it had just the opposite effect because I don't think mathematics is necessary to understand reality. And indeed, I took tremendous satisfaction from the idea that that I stood apart from the profession in believing this thing, which I think is obviously true. And so while the intention of the act was to shame me, I've still got that sign up in my office, and I get utility out of it every single day when I walk in and I see it.
I'm Stephen Dubner, and that was Freakonomics Radio. Thanks for listening. We'll be back next week. If you just can't wait that long, you can find our entire Freakonomics Radio podcast archive at freakonomics.com or at Apple Podcasts, where you can also subscribe. Talk to you later.